another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host, researcher, and friend, Jenny McGrath, founder of Endwell Movement. Jenny, I'm a little bit excited for today. This is a theme that I've been kind of digging into, at least one aspect of this theme. What I'm talking about overall, I've been heading this way for a long time, but I wanted to dive deep into the cover-up culture because there's a lot of things that are just simply covered up. And not many people think about it. There's two things that go with this. With the cover-up culture, you also have the stage personas, the stage acts. You have to have the cover-up culture to have the stage acts, right? Well, there's another piece of this that not many people really think about, and that is the branding. Whenever I just had this conversation yesterday with Jed. It will come out, I think, before this one, but whenever there's any sort of big repentance, whenever somebody does something that's awful in these movements, and the leaders step up and say, we take accountability, well, what they're doing generally, it's not really repentance so much as it is rebranding. They want to rebrand their image because their image has just been tainted. And I started thinking through this, and there's so many different ways that you can attack this, but as it relates to Youth with a Mission, I wanted to hear your perspective of what you feel about YWAM's branding.
Yeah, I'm really excited to dive into this with you. One of the things that comes to mind as you start to talk about it is how I even got into YWAM in the first place. I was still a senior in high school. And at that time, I really felt that God was calling me to Africa. And I have an entire book coming out about how I ended up with that feeling and what led to that. And but for today, I went to this missions conference at my church with my mom because I was looking for some way to do like a short-term missions for the summer after I graduated. And I went in and I was like, you know what? I want to go to Africa, so I'm only going to look at missions trips that are going to Africa, which in the first place, as I say this, I'm like, this was literally a convention for missions trips. Like, it was booths of people promoting their missions trips, which in itself, we could talk so much about that. And there was one man who was there with his team from YWAM, and they were talking about a trip that they were going to be taking to China that summer. And it was the year that the Olympics were in China. And I kind of could care less, honestly, because I was like, my heart's in Africa. I don't care about China. But this guy with this huge smile and this very charismatic personality really drew my mom and I in and was like, come talk to us. Let me tell you why you should come to China. And my mom did not come that night intending to go on a missions trip. It was all about where I was going to go. And we ended up leaving that evening with both my mom and I going, I guess we're going to go on a missions trip to China. And we did. We went on a 2-week missions trip to China. And during the time of getting ready for that was when I was invited to the community nights in the Colorado Springs YWAM base that was 30 minutes from my home. And so it just kind of just immediately enveloped me. And a big part of it was this shiny, happy people and this really charismatic, bright, smiling culture. And there was something in that that really captivated me. And so I think when I think about branding, I think about, again, shiny, happy people. I can't wait. I hope they do a season on YWAM because I feel like it fits right in with the brand. That's one of the things that comes to mind.
You know, I was talking with Jed, and it's really weird because you and I come from such different backgrounds. You always go towards the shiny, happy people, always go towards the doom and gloom and the world is ending, all of this. But yet, at the same time, there are elements that are just so similar. And part of what I connected with Jed on, when he was talking about IHOP KC, they're talking about the prophetic history, all of this stuff. Well, we had the same thing, and pretty much every cult has its own mythology. It's all called different things, and what we escaped, I called it the life stories. We would talk about Branham's life stories. This is how the gift of God came to him, all of this stuff. And whenever you talk to new people and you're trying to get them to, basically you're recruiting them, that's what you talk about. Did you know this life story? You talk about it. And in IHOP KC, you would say, do you know the prophetic history? These guys got together and God came down. There's just so many spins that you can do on the mythologies. What was it like whenever you joined YWAM, or when you were interested in joining, did they go through any of that type of history, and what was this called?
Yeah, so as part of a discipleship training school, you are required to read Lauren Cunningham, who was the founder of YWAM's books, and they were filled with these really grandiose stories of miracles. Like, the one I remember was that they needed money, and God told them to go look in a fish's mouth, and they opened this fish's mouth, and there was money in it, and it was the exact same amount that they needed. And so there's all of these really grandiose miracle stories, and it does feel like it becomes almost this mystery cult, because it's like, well, how do I get enough skill or enough faith or put myself really in enough danger that God is going to have to come through for me? And it continues this, I think, an addictive cycle in terms of addiction to cortisol and adrenaline and stress, because you believe that God is going to break through any moment. And, you know, I heard over the years many, 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 many stories of these huge miracles. I never witnessed them personally, right? And so then there becomes this dissonance of, what am I doing wrong? How come God is showing up in these ways? And it didn't even occur to me, maybe these stories aren't true. I was like, why would anyone lie to me, especially in a missions organization? And, you know, it was in several years ago, I was talking to someone. This is embarrassing to me that this was this recent. And I was telling this story where I was supposed to go on outreach and I didn't have enough money. And my parents had already invested thousands of dollars into my YWAM experience. And I had this inkling where I said, God doesn't want me to ask you for more money. So if money doesn't come in, I'm not going to go on outreach. And my parents were like, you need to finish what you started. You need to go. And I was like, no, I'm not going to go unless God provides. And then mysteriously, an anonymous donation was made for exactly the amount I needed. And I was telling a friend this, and they're like, and you're sure your dad didn't just call the YWAM base and give them And I tried asking him about it. He didn't even remember, because it was really non-consequential to him. But for me, it was like, oh my gosh, this is proof. I listened to God. God did what I want. And it really becomes these self-fulfilling prophecies without questioning where the money's coming from and how these acts of God might just be concerned family members trying to keep people from not eating and things like that.
You know, it's odd because I love sci-fi and movies, and we recently started watching Severance. I don't know if you've seen this or not. It's on Apple TV.
Yes.
And they started talking about the cult that is the foundation of this organization. It's called, the organization's called Lumen, and it's the cult of Keir Egan or something like this, right? And so they're working, and it kind of reminds me, if you take The Office television show, but it's written by Stephen King.
Totally.
They've got these books, and you've got to know the history of Keir Egan, and Keir says, do this and do this. I got to thinking, actually, I was thinking about you and YWAM, not just because of the structure, which is very similar, this life story kind of thing, but the leader looked a little bit like Lauren Cunningham, which was really funny to me.
Totally.
I'm watching this, and I'm kind of addicted. I've not finished it yet, but the deeper I go into it, I know where they're headed with it. They're headed with this dystopian type future where businesses can do all kinds of things, but I don't know if they recognize that most of that's already in existence. That was kind of the life that we grew up in. We had to believe these fictional stories, and I'll never forget the shock whenever I first began to examine the ones that we grew up with. I was like, oh my gosh, how many times can a person lie and still be calling himself a Christian? It just doesn't make sense to me. And then I started, you know, as this branched out and I'm looking at all of these different prophetic histories, life stories, supernatural experiences, I started noticing that they're all doing the same kind of thing, but they don't really care so long as they can attract people to it and then claim that they're leading them to God. So it's like the ends justifies the means, I think, is behind all of the branding that they've created.
Yes, definitely. And it makes me think, I was in South Africa on a YWAM base for about a year during YWAM's 50th anniversary. And Lauren Cunningham was making a world tour to different YWAM hubs. And so South Africa had this huge celebration in this massive, massive building. There was like pyrotechnics and a lightsaber show, and just like it was like Broadway style production. And again, when you're in that world, you're like, yeah, we're celebrating 50 years. And then you zoom out and you go, yeah, and that was the same base that I was eating mayonnaise and lettuce at for 6 months, because for whatever reason, there didn't seem to be money for the budget for that. And then it's like, well, where did all of the money for this branding come from? Because it really does, it feels like it's such a hype culture. And no matter what you're going through personally, you just need to keep coming to these worship events, which are always incredibly elaborate and evocative and emotional. And so then you kind of just circle way right back to, okay, I just need to keep investing in this.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've noticed is that they're really good at the stories, because the story themselves is not that interesting, but they know how to create the tension that attracts the listeners or the readers to know more about the story. Just like any good storyteller, you're going to have the villain, and the villain rises up against the hero, and then the two clash and the hero wins, everybody's happy. Well, picture watching Superman without Lex Luthor. He's just flying around doing good. Nobody's going to watch it. You have to have that tension. And I started looking through the Voice of Healing magazines, which is the precursor to a lot of these things we're talking about. This was a generator of fantastic stories for hero worship. That's the best way I can describe this. You've got hundreds, if not thousands, of ministers who are joining into this thing. You've got people like, there's a boy with a plastic eyeball. He's going around from convention to convention, and it's like a magician's trick. He says, I can see, God gave me the power to see. When I lost my eyeball and they put a plastic one in, I can cover up my good eye and I can see with this through the power of God. And it reminds me of, you know, like a carnival. You go and you see the crazy things that people are doing. That's really what this is. But there has to be that tension. There has to be, oh my gosh, he's lost his eye, which is a true story. It's horrific. But then they're adding the fictional element. There's no way this kid can see through a plastic eyeball. That's just not how this works. But that was the kind of thing that began all of this. In today's world, if you were to try to recruit for a youth with a mission and have this boy with a plastic eyeball with you, not a single parent would let their children go to this, right? But back in the 40s and 50s, that's the kind of thing that was happening. Well, what they did was they learned the pattern. And once you learn the pattern, I can bring the pattern, I can show something that's disastrous, and then show God on the other side, and I'm going to fake a few things to make God seem more powerful than he is. The problem that I have with this is, when you do this, you're faking God. And when you're faking God, now when somebody discovers it, they're like, wait a minute, is God real? Do I really believe this? And that's really the path where a lot of people go. And I don't think the leadership recognizes the connection there. If you're doing an ends justifies the means where you can actually lie or create fiction to attract people, and you think you're attracting them to Christianity, the moment they find out you're tricking them, I'm done. I want to walk away from this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes me think of our conversation with Shelby recently about the kind of in or out of YWAM, where it's like, as soon as you start questioning and going, was this real? You're immediately labeled a Jezebel or someone who's trying to lead people astray. And, you know, because of my own story and my own experience, I had developed a pretty unquestioning mind, which I don't actually think is how I am naturally. I'm actually a very cynical person and I question a lot. I think I have my Polish grandmother running deep in me that questions everything. But because, again, I think of a lot of the socialization of purity culture, I had been trained and conditioned into an affect of naivete, which really made me just kind of not question, especially if God was involved. It was like, I don't even want to question whether this is true or not, you know. And I'm thinking about how YWAM has its own publishing company. And if you look at YWAM Publishing and you click on like shop all, the very first category is like hero biographies. And it's this world where what you're saying is all glory is to God, but what you're really saying is all glory is to these people that are quote unquote heroes in the ministry or in the movement. And I think that that is a really important thing when it comes to these stories, that it is like this lore and these heroes and these people that get really idolized and can do no wrong, which, as you talk about cover up, I think that only creates a power vacuum that sets up for a lot of the harm that happens in YWAM.
Let's dive deeper in that just a bit. The harm that happens. I don't know that leadership connects this as well. I know some people who are in leadership who do some of the things we're talking about, and I know these are good people with good intentions. They're caught up in a system that enables this kind of thing. But so when you're in this type of system where you've got these fantastical stories, well, there becomes this sense of pressure that you too have to do this. You have to be part of this. I remember listening to these life stories and all the miraculous things that we were led to believe. And all the while we're led to believe it, we're hearing things like, one day you too can do this. You too are a manifested son of God. There's different ways that the pastor spun it. But essentially, if you had the power of the Holy Spirit, you too would have similar supernatural experiences. And that was the attraction. That was like the, back to the carnival days, that was the guy that's saying, step right up, take your ticket. That's what was happening in our heads. We wanted this. We wanted to do something special that was a miracle that nobody else could do. I want to perform this magic trick. The problem is you never ever get to do it. And there, I know that there are people who, if you are in a Pentecostal type religion, there are the spiritual gifts, there's the speaking in tongues, this kind of thing. And I'm not going to even get into that debate, but what I'm talking about more to the point are the really, really fantastical things. The things that the leadership can only do, that the members are following like the carrot on the stick. Come with me and you too can do this. You too can raise the dead. You too can heal a person. I have yet to see an actual proven raising from the dead. Not one. I know many people that have claimed it. I've studied the histories. But that's a fantastic thing that everybody wants to be able to do, especially if you've got a dying loved one. But when it comes right down to it, only the leadership claim that they can do it. And the rank and file member who's in the same religion, who has the same access to the Holy Spirit, they never can do it. And so it leads me to believe that there's something wrong. The leadership is just really not being honest with the people.
Yeah, it's like everything is just out of grasp. It's just out of reach. It's like you hear second or third hand of these stories from people that you love and that you trust. And so you're like, well, if this person is telling me this, of course it's not going to be fake. It's not going to be unreal. And there were so many stories of, you know, people growing back a limb or someone who'd been paralyzed their whole life standing up and walking. And I had a lot of faith, and I was in the ministry for a very long time, and I didn't see any of that. And I would like to believe that there are things that happen in this world that I don't understand and that are miraculous, absolutely. But I think what feels really sinister about that is the power that then is given to the people who claim these miraculous stories, and the harm that they do, the violence that they do to people in the name of healing, and what gets used as justification to have access to people and to do things that are inappropriate and abuses of power. I think that is, it's not necessarily like people having faith that wild things can happen we don't understand. It's how our leaders using these stories and these narratives to continue to grow the disparity between who has power and who doesn't.
Yeah, and I think that's really the key, is who has power and who doesn't. I have seen things that I can't explain, but usually they're things that could have an explanation. They're things that, you know, I've seen people who got healed. And truly, I believe if you read the Bible is very clear that God heals people. So if you're a Christian and you believe this, there's no question as to whether there's a healing. But then there's this case that gets... the best example I can give is this. There are diseases that your body can heal itself. Bacteria infection, for example. You might die of the bacteria infection, but you also might conquer it. Your body might conquer it. But go to war and have an explosion that takes off part of your leg. The fantastic stories that I've heard of where people were growing legs back. And yes, if you read the Bible, that could happen, but I sincerely doubt that any single leader in this movement ever grew a leg back. But we grew up hearing those stories that they did. And that's problematic for me, because I've reached the point where, no, they were just lying through their teeth. Show me one person whose leg actually was chopped off and grew back. It's just not the way life works, sadly. Now, again, there can be miracles. There can be things that can be unexplained. I just have yet to see a leg grow back. There were tricks where one of the tricks was the leg would be shorter, and so they would sit a person who really didn't have a problem at all, but set their torso just slightly tilted. So when you're looking from the audience side, one leg truly looks longer than the other. They're praying over them and twisting them and working that leg. Well, they twist the torso and now their legs straighten up. And I think that's where the rumor came from. They grew the leg. The leg was shorter, but never was it ever chopped off. And I grew up hearing some weird stories like this, right? Well, what happens is, sadly, and this is part of just humanity, what happens is one person might hear the story, I watched the leg grow longer, and not knowing that that's a stage trick, right? Well, as that rumor spreads, somebody tells the story slightly incorrectly, and then another person hears it. Well, your mind has difficulty sometimes remembering how you heard it. And there are people who claim that they saw things they didn't actually see. They just heard another person tell them. And that's just part of how the rumor mill works. But rumor mill, if you understand ancient history, rumor mill evolves into mythologies. Mythologies evolves into deities. And then eventually you have children being sacrificed to deities in the ancient world. That's how all of this developed. It suddenly hit me. I'd probably left the Branham religion for maybe 7 years. And I was really studying the ancient mythology, and it finally hit me. We're actually in the early stages of this with this type of religion. We have this array of people that have made false claims. The false claims were from the 40s and 50s. Those have evolved into outlandish stories that just can't be true. And you have people like... what's an example? Benny Hinn. I listened to this Benny Hinn speech saying, did you know William Branham could do this, that, and the other? Well, every single thing that he named, we have disproven. So he has adopted part of that mythology, and he may believe it for all I know, but he doesn't realize that it's not true. Well, everybody who listens to him, now they adopt it, and then they spread it. And eventually, this turns into this weird worship of a man who was just this guy from Kentucky. And I look back at all the Greek and Roman gods. This thing has played out for millennia. And the problem that I have is that evolves into a mythology, which is a different god. It's not Christianity. And the worship of the human is certainly not Christianity. Now go back to YWAM. As I've been studying Youth with a Mission, I don't find Lauren Cunningham being worshipped in the same way. However, I see some of the stories. And so the question is forming in my mind with Youth with a Mission. Are we too early for this to have happened? Will it eventually evolve into hero worship of Lauren Cunningham? Or is it already kind of happening and I'm just not aware of it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, it's what's funny is I remember even the huge deal that it was that Lauren Cunningham was coming to South Africa. And we would joke about it. Like I said, like, I want us all to like make shirts with Lauren Cunningham's face on it. And, you know, and it was sort of like, ha ha, we're not a cult. but I think we were all like appeasing some tension that we felt because we really were, you know, and we had to read his book. Is That Really You, God? Like anyone who enters into it has to read this book. And he is really, you know, there's so much of that. But I was thinking about, it's actually like, I don't even know if I'd say one step removed from child sacrifice, in that there were so many youths sacrificing ourselves. We were literally willing to die for Lauren Cunningham's mission, and what we believed God had ordained him to do. And there are people who have died in YWAM. You know, I was 17 years old when I was signing up for my DTS. So my parents literally had to sign the forms that say, if I die overseas, YWAM is not going to pay for my body to get sent back to my parents. They are responsible for that. And tragically, there are people that have died in various schools, on various bases, in really tragic ways. And that is considered a martyr. It's considered a sacrifice. And so it really is this domino effect where I think it's already there. But similarly to all these shiny, happy things, it's in a very opaque way, where it's not like serious, but the practicality of how it actually affects lives and deaths is very, very real.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. It's so hard for me as I'm listening to you talk. I keep thinking of Severance and Kier. You're talking about the books and the literature, and I'm, you know, in my head, I'm going back to the same way that they were doing the books and literature, that was just lifting this Kier person into authority, and he's dead, which is, it's just so odd. I grew up in the same way. The book is, I think in Severance, it's called The Compliance Handbook, and it's all of the rules, and they've got these weird phrases that they use that give you the rules. Well, in our in our group, it was called Conduct Order Doctrine. We had this big, thick thing that was just this Kentucky hillbilly English, all of these rules that we had, and they were how you would behave when you were in the church. It was just so odd when I think about it, the similarities. But then, so I'm in the part of the series, and I hate to use that as the basis for this episode, but it is just so similar. I'm at the part of the series where the outside world is beginning to understand that there's something unusual happening in this place. And I'm comparing that to what I grew up with. The outside world did recognize that there was some weirdness happening inside this group I was in. And I've read through some of the news reports of youth with a mission. The problem in each one of these cases, from the severance example to my example to youth with a mission, the media is not fully educated as to what is happening. They don't know the loaded language. They often don't understand the harm that's being caused. They just see the superficial. If somebody were to come and tell their story, they know that story, but they don't really dig deep enough. And as I'm looking through some of the news reports and the advertisements for Youth with a Mission, now you've got this weird, complex situation because, yes, there are some stories out there that are very critical, but the social media is shaping it in such a way that it makes it sound positive and will even spin some of the critical things in a positive way. So you've got, on the one hand, social media coming in and affecting it. Then you also have some of the, there are some journal reports that just praise the group to no end because they don't know what's happening on the inside. So you've got literal testimonies of journalists who are in favor of the mission. You've got social media shaping all of this, and it turns into this weird cycle where when somebody wants to step out of the cycle, you're kind of lost. What do you do? You've got everything is against you. And as I'm talking through that, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. Whenever you decided to come out of this, what was it like entering into that cycle that the entire thing is against you?
I had a very unique and I would say fortunate experience because I was still on staff with YWAM when I went to graduate school. And the understanding and the agreement was that I would go to graduate school for 3 years and then I would move back to Uganda. And even during my summers in graduate school, I went back to Uganda for the whole summer. And so it was sort of this like transitionary object that I got that most people don't, because I was in YWAM but not in YWAM. There wasn't a base that I knew of in Seattle. I wasn't around YWAMers. So I was just out living my life. And it was interesting, even when I did that, I have a lot of contact with my quote unquote leaders in YWAM. It was sort of like I felt like I just didn't exist unless I was doing a YWAM ministry. And for me, going to graduate school and everything I was experiencing was really important. And I felt like I was sort of out on my own. So by the time I left staff with YWAM, no one really cared because I had already been gone for 3 years. But I think, I've shared this before, I also then, when I was in Seattle, was going to Mars Hill Church. And so I was still in this world, and my reasons for leaving were a little bit vague at the time. I wasn't as clear as I am now about what the harm, I think, YWAM was. And honestly, it was really in a lot of sharing stories with my husband, where I would just share them like normal stories, and he would go, "What the heck are you talking about? You did what? And they did what?" And I was like, but it was fun. And again, I think that's that brand indoctrination, is that everything was an adventure. So as dangerous as it was, as unhealthy as it was, as toxic as it was, as fill in the blank, it was part of this like, oh, but I felt so alive and I was so free and it was such an adventure, which I think is so baked into the DNA of YWAM that it is this sense of no matter what you're going through, you can always spin it to be really exciting.
Yeah, let's talk about that a minute. I've often thought about the networks that are promoting this thing. I actually came across, I don't know if I should go there or not. There was a very bad thing that recently happened in America. There was a person who became mentally unstable and somebody died. I'm going to leave it at that because it was a very tragic event. The church that they came out of was connected to Youth with a Mission. And that connection doesn't imply that YWAM caused this or anything like that. But I started noticing the networks. And I began to realize that that was networked because there was a college involved. The college was networked to Youth with a Mission because why not? You've got students graduating college or who are even attending college. And those are networked to, believe it or not, International House of Prayer in Kansas City. So as you've got this big, complete circle of networks, and that goes far beyond even just those, you've got this funnel where you can recruit people. And the branding that you have to do, it would almost have to be something that is adventurous, because you're not going to say, we're going to go to the backside of the desert and we're going to spend all of this time with your children and we're going to struggle while we're there. Nobody's going to send their kids. But if you say, hey, we're going to take them on an adventure for God, there's a little bit of twist that you can do with what your mission is and make it sound fun, sound entertaining. And then the problem is, like I mentioned with the people who discover some of the trickery that's happening, when a child gets in there or a young adult gets in there and realizes that it's not quite the adventure that they were told, that's where, for me, that's where it becomes a little bit questionable. Do you sense that that is the case, or were the adventures, was the way that they advertised the adventures the way that they ended up being?
Yes and no, I would say. And that's what is still a complex thing, is that I live in a van. Because I love travel and I love experiencing different places and people and culture and how even food influences things. And so when you are traveling around the world, I think, there's usually some sense of adventure to it, where everything is new, everything is exciting, and it is not exactly what you imagine it's going to be. When my mom and I were sold on China, it was, you're going to be in these little tea houses in the middle of the mountains because people want to learn English. And it was just this really kind of dramatic and romanticized idea, and we can also spend time talking about the fetishization of other cultures and how that also is problematic. But there was this sense of, oh my gosh, it's so romantic. And again, there was adventure there, but it wasn't at all like we imagined it would be. And we spent a lot of time in cities, unsure what we were doing. Usually a lot of things aren't planned out. And so it gets spun as like, we just want to stay open to God. But most of the time it's because you have 18, 19 year olds leading people internationally who just didn't do a lot of pre-planning ahead of time. And so then you have things like running out of money, not having proper food, people getting heat exhaustion. There's people that have lost limbs on outreaches from accidents. Like really, really serious things happen. There have been people that have like had to kill their own wildlife to eat while they were on outreach. And again, these aren't like people that have been trained for this at all. This is 19, 20-year-olds that are stuck in the middle of the desert somewhere without a way to get food. And so, it's complicated. And I think it is sort of the quintessential abusive relationship, where there is this positive reinforcement intermittently, where there's just enough really sweet moments and there's just enough really good moments to make you go, okay, maybe things will be different now. Okay, maybe things will be different now. But then I think the more you're in it, it gets actually fewer and far between that you have those moments. But by then you've been so invested for so long that you don't really know what you would do in the outside world. And so it kind of becomes this point of no return for a lot of people that might want to leave, but economically, relationally, just really don't know how to make that possible.
Whenever I was looking into the networks that were all connected, and it's really weird, some of the connections, you find some of the more modern churches, you find some Pentecostal churches, there's this big range, right? And as I was looking through some of the Pentecostal churches that are connected, I was thinking about the way, if you're in the Pentecostal world, there's this idea of a calling. And nobody really can explain how this is. There are people who say, I was called to be a minister. Well, what was this like? I've had people tell me, I heard an audible voice of God tell me this. And maybe they did, I don't know, but it's a little bit out there. And then you have other people, well, I just felt it in my soul. And so the question is, well, was that intuition? Was that just your gut feeling? And if you're in the Pentecostal world, that calling is very real, and I'm not trying to belittle it at all. But on the other side of the equation, you've got, if you're in a more modern mainstream church, the calling is just, you're called to be a Christian, and you're called to do good to other people. And the calling is something that everybody has. It's not a special elite thing that certain people get, right? And so that's really, for me, the difference that I'm trying to wade through. But as I was looking through all of the different connections to Youth with a Mission, I was thinking about, what about the Pentecostals that come? Did they have this idea that God's calling your youth to come be with us? And if they hesitate, was it like some in the Pentecostal world, if you hesitate, you're disobeying God? Did you ever see anything like this, or is that disconnected from Youth with a Mission?
Yeah. I mean, the phrase calling bore so much agony for me in YWAM. It was this moving target that you were constantly trying to figure out of, what is my calling? And I don't know if this is true for all bases, but I knew some of the bases that I was on staff at, and they believed that a woman was called to her husband. So whatever her husband was called to, she kind of just had to follow him, which was convenient for the men in those relationships. But, you know, I experienced this, and I didn't come from a charismatic or a Pentecostal world, but what I research is this very unique moment in 2004, which is this other whole movement. There was a documentary style film called Invisible Children, where three young college men from Southern California did this documentary style film about a war that was going on in Northern Uganda. And they did this very highly dramatized and erotically charged film about child soldiers. And I myself was one of many, 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 many young white women who watched that documentary and was hugely moved emotionally, and then said, God is calling me to Uganda. So by the time I was 14, I was begging my parents to let me drop out of high school and move to Uganda. And they were like, that's not going to happen. But a lot of times calling is so associated with emotion. And what do you feel the most emotion towards? Let's not question it. Let's not wonder how this film has used affective technology to manipulate you to feel a certain way. Let's just notice what you're feeling, and that's the call of God. And there's this really problematic phrase that's popular in YWAM, and I think other missions organizations as well, that says, God does not call the qualified, he qualifies the called. So you have so many people stepping into roles of teaching, of school, of hospitals, of all of these different things that we were not qualified for, but we were called. And so that was all that we needed. And so by the time I was 19 years old, I was leading congregations of hundreds of people in Northern Uganda with no right to be doing that, other than I was called to Northern Uganda. So God was opening these doors for me, and I wasn't questioning the hundreds of years of racial hierarchy and harm that had created a system for me to be able to step into those positions of power. And even then, I would agonize all the time. Like, what is God calling me to? What is God calling me to do today? Like, call was such a ball and chain, really, for me in that movement.
Yeah, I can expect that would be problematic. And you're talking about the emotions. That's another thing the branding I've noticed in not just this, but some of the others. The branding is such that it appeals to those emotions. And so the calling makes a lot more sense with the branding. Now, is that necessarily bad? I don't know. You know, if you're in a Christian religion, you would expect some emotional connection. But when I'm thinking about, and again, I keep going back to the Severance show, when I'm thinking about this crazy book of these life stories and histories and brandings that I don't know if I believe all of it, whenever you put emotion that is tied to the mission, which is tied to the life stories or the prophetic histories or whatever you call your group's particular thing, your mythology, whenever that emotion is tied to that mythology, instead of being tied to Jesus and Christ, the Holy Spirit, you have to wonder, is the branding really Christian? And that's really, if I was to drive to a question in this podcast, it would be really that. As it relates to the branding and the way that they pitched it, was the mission something that you would have considered to be branded as pointing people to Jesus or pointing people to the mission? And that's really, for me, that's the bottom line question.
I say this with the caveat that I know my answer might upset people, so I hold that, and you can disagree with me, but I would say yes, but I would say that it is part of the white, capitalistic Christian Jesus that we have been conditioned to believe in. Was it following the brown Jewish man from Palestine and his messaging? I don't think so. But was it following what Randall Balmer distinguishes Christianity with Christendom, which I think is such a helpful reframe? So I would actually say, like, it felt like it was Christendom, like it was this empire, you know, again, we get back to Seven Mountains Mandate Christianity, which to me, I think following Jesus and believing in what Jesus said is a lot more diverse and open to that. I think, you know, of early Christianities that existed before Orthodoxy became really convenient for the Roman Empire to say, this is what Christianity needs to look like. And so I feel like it's such a complicated thing for me personally, where I'm still deconstructing what I think Christianity is, because I think we have had thousands of years of it being really, the systems that we're talking about with YWAM are not new systems. They've been around since about 300 AD-ish, I would say.
I'm actually glad you went there, because growing up, I actually did not know that Jesus was not white. We had this particular painting that we had to have of Jesus. That's the one Jesus looks like. That was part of our part of our loaded language. Jesus looks like this, part of our mythologies. And whenever I stopped to think about what Jesus actually looked like, it wasn't just the skin color that bothered me. It was all of the ways that he behaved, how he would sit with the sinners and help the sinners to become better, sit with the poor and needy. Yes, he did heal the sick, but that wasn't really the emphasis. It was making the world a better place. And when I look at where I came from, it definitely wasn't doing that. But now spread it into the broader movement, and you've got this real problem, because the Jesus that they're pitching doesn't really resemble the Jesus that's in the Bible. It's a little bit different. And so I thought I would end with this question. How would you brand this in a healthy way? Because what they're doing actually could be a good thing. I'm not going to lie. The mission could be a good thing. But how would you brand it? How would you present it? How would you declare it in such a way that wasn't painting it into something it was not, but instead painting it to something that was good?
I am pretty a firm believer that anything that becomes a monoculture is not going to be a healthy culture. And whether that is our microbiome in our gut, or whether that is the types of farms that we're growing, or the types of community, I think we need diversity. And we need things to look and feel differently. And so I personally am a little skeptical of branding, because it feels like it congeals something into a thing. And a question that I ask in my book and that I sit with often is, why didn't Jesus write his own gospel? If he came to bring the best news in all of the world, why did he not write that down for us? And of course, I answer my own question and someone else might have a different answer, but I think he was actually more concerned with being with people and loving people. And he didn't, in my reading exhibit a lot of a sense of urgency or calling or mission. It was, how do you love the people that are right in front of you? How do you do the thing that is the hardest? How do you sit with the people that culture says are wrong? And I think that that is incredibly applicable in the world that we have right now, where there are entire groups of people that are attempting to be eradicated. And how do we allow ourselves to be more like Jesus, to be with those people that think and act and look and live differently than what empire or Christendom says they should look like?
Yeah, I've thought about that too. It's interesting because if you write a set of laws, those laws apply to that culture, and as culture grows and many of the things that you're writing the laws about don't really apply any longer, it becomes a stale religion. And Jesus did not come and do this. He did not come and write a rule book. But what has happened over time is they've tried to make it into a rule book. So when I was reading the Gospels, we were finely tuned to pick out which verses we thought were rules for us so that we could abide by it. And I'm reading this as a, you know, as a teenager thinking, man, they did some strange things in the ancient world. How does that rule apply to me? And it's like straining at a gnat to try to figure out how you can apply this ancient culture thing to a modern application. And then I came across the passage where Jesus says the entire Old Testament, the law and the prophets, are summed up in love God, love your neighbor as yourself. And then it just started to click. I started to realize that what we're doing was so wrong. It isn't about the rules. It isn't about even trying to, we had this idea that we had to present ourselves holy. And I think that's where our shiny, happy people was somewhat similar to yours. We had to present ourselves in a way that would appeal to other people if we wanted to recruit them. So we also had a shiny, happy, while doomsday, sad kind of atmosphere, which is really, really weird if you think about it. But I began to understand that it's more than this. You're leaving a good footprint on the world. And even if the world should come to a quick end, which I no longer believe in that mindset, but even if it did, if you're leaving a good footprint, what does it matter? If you're helping another person, what does it matter? If the person next to you who did not accept Christ, who is not a Christian, who doesn't want Christianity, if you're kind to that person, are you not doing exactly what Jesus did when Jesus sat with the sinners and the prostitutes? So I started to look at things differently. And as it relates to branding, I don't find too many things like this. You don't find branding of the Jesus sitting with the people that are despised. In today's world, I hate to go here because I'll get hate mail, but in today's world, they have so far politicized things like homosexuality. It's a political Christian topic right now. But what if you had a picture of Jesus sitting with two homosexuals who, if you believe the Bible and you believe this is sin, well, Jesus would sit with them in the same way that he sat with the sinners in the Bible. But if you were to paint that picture today, there would be people that just wouldn't come to church. And they would say, they put up their hands and say, our politics won't allow us to do this. But they would use the word Christianity instead of politics. And for me, that is the real problem here. They have painted with the branding, and not just Youth with a Mission, but a lot of these groups, they have made their branding such that the branding can't fit Jesus. The branding fits the organization. And if you're a watcher of Severance, they have created the religion of Kier.
Yeah, that's a great reference for this conversation.
I can't get it out of my head. And whenever I look at that guy, he kind of looks like Lauren Cunningham, which is really funny. So it's just all around a good reference. I don't know that it's the best show that I've watched. In the first 8 or 9 episodes, it took me a long time to get into it. But once I did, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like almost every cult that I have examined. And it's crazy. So thank you so much for doing this.
Yes, thanks so much for having me.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org and endwellmovement.com. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.